We wrapped up another busy week on Friday, June 12th, right here on Connecticut Today. Andre Domino from the Italian-American One Voice Coalition stopped by in the 3 o'clock hour to talk about the violence and vandalism hitting several statues and memorials to Christopher Columbus all around the country. Brian Forrester stopped by in the 4 o'clock hour. He is involved in the podcast and the webpage instoresnow.com to chat about the financial problems the UConn Athletic Department is facing. And in the 5 o'clock hour, we talked to Republican State Senator Kevin Kelly of Stratford. He's the ranking member on the Aging Committee in Hartford, along with being an elder care attorney. Kevin talked about the tragic number of COVID-19 deaths in Connecticut nursing homes and ways that we can perhaps make sure that doesn't happen again. We had him on around Columbus Day for an obvious reason. Andre Domino is an executive board member of the Italian-American One Voice Coalition with thousands of members coast to coast. You see him on television, see him in print, and hear him on radio all over. I want to talk about some of the statues that are getting torn down now in various cities. It's not just statues of questionable military leaders in this country. Again, statues, memorials, remembrances to Christopher Columbus, for whatever reason, are being targeted as well. Andre, Paul here at WICC. Good to talk with you again, sir. How are you?
Good to be back with you, Paul.
From afar, what do you see going on here, and what's your reaction to that?
Well, I just don't get it. I mean, certainly the tragedy with George Floyd is one thing, and, you know, being upset with the Confederate soldiers and so forth. But what does Christopher Columbus have to do with this? Why are they tearing down these statues now in 4 cities around the country? It's just ridiculous. Columbus is an important symbol to Italian Americans. He's an important symbol to Western culture. Why are they doing this?
Is it simply because it's low-hanging fruit, quote-unquote? You know, any statue must be pulled down. I mean, heck, they were in England. They vandalized the statue of Winston Churchill, for God's sake.
Yeah, no, listen, I think, candidly, we see the world, our country is going a little bit crazy now. But specifically when it comes to Columbus, of course, there's that incorrect false narrative about all the atrocities, supposedly, that Columbus brought to this part of the world. You know, when he got here, this was no Garden of Eden. You know, the Native Americans were pretty good at slavery and atrocities, and he was a man of his times. We don't hold Native Americans to today's standards. They can't hold to Columbus to today's standards. So, you know, they've got to get off this false narrative about Columbus and leave him alone, because Columbus statues and Columbus Day are important things to Italian Americans.
Now, which statues, Andre? Obviously, you've kept abreast of this. You said, what, 3 or 4 of them have been either defaced or torn down? And did I read that there's a move now to pull down more of them? What's the actual update on this?
It's really unbelievable, Paul. In Richmond, Virginia, they painted it, they set it on fire, and then they threw it in the river. In Boston, they beheaded the statue, and now the mayor capitulated and said he's going to take the statue away. In St. Paul, Minnesota, they defaced the statue. And, of course, you know, there was actually a GoFundMe page trying to raise a bounty of $1 million to get the head off the statue of Columbus in Columbus Circle in New York City, that iconic statue. It's just outrageous.
And is that still up on GoFundMe, Andre? Do you have any idea whether they're allowing that to continue or not?
No. We immediately attacked that and said that GoFundMe was fostering a criminal action, and that page was taken down. But it just tells you the sentiment of these people. They're just going nuts out there. And, you know, these are all really, Paul, these are hate crimes. Because Italian Americans, these statues were put up as an atonement. You got to remember that there was the largest lynching in America was of Italian Americans in New Orleans. In fact, last year, the New Orleans mayor apologized for that lynching. So, you know, Columbus was a way for the government to atone for the negative attitude towards Italian Americans back in the late 1800s. So attacking these symbols now is attacking Italian Americans as a hate crime.
What do you think, Andre, is going to happen further? I mean, are any more of these statues on a quote-unquote hit list? Do you or your organization, do you have a complete listing of what statues or memorials or vestiges of Columbus may be targeted here or not?
Yes, we have been receiving from our many members across the country notifications about different areas that people are claiming they're going to go after the statue. We've tried alerting the authorities. Unfortunately, you know, today in this environment that we're in, Paul, you know, the police and stuff have their hands full as it is, and we don't know if Columbus is going to rise to that level of importance. But after all, it is criminal vandalism, and it is a hate crime against Italian Americans. But we're watching it all across the country.
So if you Andre, or your organization contacts these police departments again, what is the response you're getting from them?
Well, you know, when we notify them by email, and we call officials when we can, you know, they'll take the information down. We don't know if they're going to do anything about it. You know, of course, as I said, I don't know if their priorities right now are there. We've got a crazy time in our country now, but we would hope that the local authorities would do something about it. And we actually hope these people that are protesting, rioting, and so forth, you know, change their direction. They're going after the Confederate statues. That's bad. But don't go after the Columbus. That certainly has nothing to do with this situation with George Floyd.
But there would be people, Andre, and I get calls on my show sometimes from them, who say, listen, maybe this is a time that we should confront all wrongdoing, and in their opinion, Columbus was a wrongdoer. Let me play devil's advocate here. What do you say to that argument?
Well, you know, they can have an opinion, but they can't have their own facts. That's not just factual. If you go to the reputable sources, you see that he did nothing of the atrocities that they say. They say he invented slavery. That's a joke. I mean, the slavery was rampant throughout the Americas with the indigenous people, plus all the other atrocities. He actually worked with one tribe that was fighting a cannibalistic tribe. So, you know, it's all, they can't have their own facts. And the other side of the coin is, hey, listen, if we're talking about being respectful of people, how about being respectful to Italian Americans that hold Columbus and Columbus Day up so importantly? Just as a quick story, my grandfather came here from Italy, and he worked as a longshoreman on the docks in New York, and he was spit upon. He was treated. He had the lowest pay of anybody there. And when Columbus Day came around, he felt that was one day he was proud. So why should we take that away from our heritage? Why do we have to wipe out the history of our country across the board, not just Columbus, but all these other statues? Why does history have to disappear? If we're going to look at people that have done things bad in the past, you're going to have to get rid of a lot of statues if we're talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, there comes a point, Andre, where, and there's that old phrase, right? If you forget history, you repeat it. I'm kind of paraphrasing now, but, you know, but those who don't know their history, yeah, we should be, Andre, reminded of people. And if you want to take some of these statues and say, okay, he's here, but it should also be noted, bang, 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 this happened, that happened. You don't just get rid of everything. You don't want, that's what the old Soviet Union did.
Absolutely. You know, I'm really concerned about trying to wipe out our history, not just Italian-American, but our American history. After all, Columbus Day is a federal American holiday. In 1892, it was proclaimed by President Harrison as a day of patriotism. So it started off as a day for America. Why do we have to wipe out our past? And why do these people have to keep mining history for fresh things to be upset about? It's just wrong.
Andre, tell my listeners about the Italian-American One Voice Coalition. What is that? Remind us.
Certainly. We're a nationwide organization that fights any kind of defamation and educates about the real background of Italian-Americans. You can find out about us by going to our website, which is the initials of our organization, iaovc.org, iaovc.org, for the Italian-American One Voice Coalition.
That's it. I'm looking at it right now, iaovc.org. One of the board members there, Andre Domino. Andre, good to talk to you. We'll be in touch again, probably around Columbus Day. Thanks, Andre. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Appreciate it. All right, folks. UConn is faced with some major, well, before COVID-19, we had some major financial issues with the UConn athletic program, well documented. And now with COVID-19, the athletic department at UConn and many major schools kind of backed into a corner about cuts. Joining us right now is an old radio buddy of mine. I have worked with him. Producer Eric has worked with him too. Brian Forster joins us. Check out his podcast, instoresnow.com. That's instorrs. now.com, not stores. You get it here in Stores Now. Get it? Stores Connecticut. Beautiful downtown stores. instoresnow.com. Brian, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Well, listen, I had an open show. I had to fill it with something. I'm just kidding.
Oh, I'm flattered. Thanks.
But you and your buddies there at InStoresNow.com, you follow this as closely as anybody in the state, you know, not associated with a major newspaper, radio, or TV station. It appears, Brian, that number one, Dave Benedict kind of kicked the can down the road, what, for another couple of weeks or so today? What happened?
Well, yeah, so you're absolutely right. They announced today we were expecting Dave Benedict, the athletic director, to make an announcement to say how he was going to save $10 million with the athletic department. And that was probably going to include cutting some of the major sports programs, some of the non-revenue generating sports programs. But it just came out. I've been waiting all day to find out what's going on. And it just came out that they pushed it out to June 24th. There's a public session where they're going to detail their plan. Thought it was going to be today. There's a finance meeting today. It's now June 24th. But what does it mean? I mean, we're trying to figure out how you're going to cut that $10 million, what programs are going to go. In Division One, you have to carry a minimum of 16 sports, and UConn carries 24. So does that mean they're going to cut eight teams? You got Title IX issues to deal with. There's a lot at play. So it's kind of like we're waiting till June 24th to now see what teams are cut. You've seen some of the teams, like the golf team, and the track team, trying to raise money for their season. The hope is obviously you raise enough money, it makes you a lot tougher to cut when you've already raised money for your expenses. But I don't think anybody knows. And right now too, you may see some administrative cutbacks. I've seen some rumors where it might be a quarter or even a third of the administration in the athletic department being let go to cut it down. So again, it's just rumors. UConn Twitter's been on fire the last couple of weeks. So it's kind of trying to figure out what's going to happen. They said football, everyone wants to cut football. I don't think that's going to happen. They've invested too much in football. You've got a new weight room. You're going independent. You're leaving the American. Mm-hmm. Football, I think, is going to be fine. Baseball, basketball, soccer, field hockey, I think those ones are going to be fine. You've got a national brand with a lot of those.
Yeah.
You're looking at some of these other sports like golf, like swimming, like things like that, where you don't realize how many Division I athletes
yeah,
you can
I,
have.
I mean, that's I a, you know, Brian, that's a lot. 24 teams, and I hate the term, and I know it's been used all over the place, non-revenue generating sports. That's sad because just because thousands of people don't show up for a UConn golf match, you know, shouldn't denigrate the fact that they are still Division I NCAA golfers, a level of golf that turns out, oh, geez, I don't know, people like Phil Mickelson and great pro golfers that were NCAA sure. champions. And it's just sad that, you know, those teams now have to go to their own fundraising to pay, and people might say, well, how much does golf cost? It's not clubs, balls, and tee times, Brian, as you know. It's housing, right. It's athletic scholarships, it's insurance. There's a whole lot more here.
One of the interesting things that I learned was UConn athletes are considered out-of-state students. So when you're factoring out the bill for what a scholarship costs, every UConn athlete is looked at as an out-of-state student. And so I don't know if that's an accounting trick that can be done, and you could make them in-state students and save a whole bunch of money that way on paper. I don't know. We know the UConn financing is nuts. I mean, you don't need a a magnifying glass to take a look and try to figure out where everything is. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be interesting. You know, if you cut a program, does that mean the students who are on scholarship for that, do they lose their scholarship? I don't know. You hope not, but I don't know.
And of course, Brian, and the guest is Brian Forrester from InStoresNow.com. Of course, it was well publicized last year or a couple of years ago, about a year, year and a half ago, that, you know, UConn was in the hole athletically like $40 million. I mean, that was one of the biggest athletic red ink sheets in the country, I believe.
You're definitely right. I think it was like $41 million, and part of their move from the American to the Big East is over time going to offset some of that. There's buyouts and there's different things involved there. But you figure if you're not having to fly the team to Tulsa or fly the team to East Carolina. It's mm-hmm. better to send them to St. John's. You know, you're going to save money in logistics that way. But they've got a lot to cut, and it's UConn's own fault for getting into this situation.
Yeah.
I love UConn. Don't get me wrong. UConn yeah. fan, UConn alumni. You know, I have a podcast for UConn. It's what we do. But they put themselves in this situation, and now they got to dig their way out of it.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, it's going to affect a lot of people, and mm-hmm. we're looking for that announcement today. And I was thinking maybe it'd be a news dump Friday afternoon.
Yeah,
dump,
Friday afternoon. Yeah, yeah.
Another thing to consider is unions potentially. You know, public employees of the university, if they're going to get let go, maybe they need notice. I don't know. I'm just
that's interesting. No, good point.
Why that would get pushed off?
Yeah, Brian, hang on. We'll be right back with you. A little bit more coming up with Brian Forrester. He's one of the guys behind a great website, a great podcast. Folks, if you listen to UConn here on WICC, men and women's basketball, the coaches show with Mike Crispino, football, you can supplement your coverage with instoresnow.com. Brian, hang on. Traffic and weather together. We'll check Wall Street, too, coming up 4:46 on WICC. And the website and the podcast, both in stores now, INSTORRS now is in stores. Connecticut, Brian Forrester is joining us for a few more minutes. Brian and his buddies there cover UConn about as well as anybody in the state. A lot of columns there, interviews as well. Brian, UConn football, bad attendance last year, really has been in a downward slide since that marquee win at Notre Dame, which seems like another
a long time ago.
You beat the Irish at South Bend with touchdown Jesus watching, for God's sake.
Shout out to Andre Dixon right there.
Yeah, and you know, there's all this rumbling about, do you go back down to a lower bowl division? Do you get rid of the program, but you have that big stadium there? What are your thoughts on that, Brian? Because football costs millions of dollars.
Right. But I think if you were to cut football today, you'd be cutting off your nose to spite your face. I mean, that's where you're going to make your money. You got to rebuild your program. They've actually been recruiting very well this offseason. They signed a couple big recruits this week. It's going to take time to turn it around. I mean, the way the program was just in the pits, the only way you're going to get people back to come to the games is if you start winning games. And so what I thought was good was what David Benedict was doing with their independent schedule, moving from the American, because people don't care if you're playing, I keep saying, Tulsa or East Carolina. There's no real natural rivalries in the American. So you move everything else to Big East, and then you have football move to independent. And I thought David Benedict was doing a great job setting up that schedule. He was very creative. You got a couple buy-in games with Power Five conferences. You've got a couple local games with like Maine and Massachusetts and Rhode Island, which as a UConn fan, you should beat all those teams. But, you know, he did a nice job filling a schedule when you had no schedule. So it kind of gave you some optimism moving forward. And then obviously with the pandemic, now everything's up in the air and you don't know what's going on.
Don't see them. Is there any possibility at all, Brian, realistically, that they drop football? I can't see them doing that.
There's a possibility for anything, but I think it's highly unlikely. Just because they've got too much invested in it. And you look at – it's not even just football. You look at all the new facilities that they've built recently. They just put the turf on the soccer field. I mean, some of these teams that you think they're safe because they've invested all these resources in it. Baseball, new baseball stadium coming, baseball, softball, soccer. I'd be shocked if they said football is gone. I mean, they're recruiting like they're going to play this year. They got a beautiful new weight room, and they've got a schedule that's more favorable with some of these lesser teams, with UMass, who they beat last year, and Rhode Island, Maine, some of these teams.
Is the men's hockey program safe?
They better be. They were hot at the end, you know.
Yeah, they're playing well.
I mean, Quinnipiac looks tough going into this year, but UConn men's hockey, they got a big recruit, Nick Capone, out of North Haven, who was originally supposed to go to Maine, and he's coming to UConn, so they're going to be good. They got a lot of NHL prospects on their team.
Okay, so you see, Brian Forrester, you see pretty much eight of the non-revenue generating? What are we talking? Golf, tennis, track, swimming? Is that what likely happens here? Plus departmental cuts, belt tightening?
I don't know if it's going to be eight because you have Title IX issues where you have to have the same amount of women and men's sports. It very well could be. I think people are just on edge waiting to find out what's going to get cut and what happens next. It could be as many as eight because that would take them down to the minimum of 16. Mm-hmm. So we're going to find out on June 24th at their public session, and then you go from there. But you forget how many great teams are at UConn.
Yeah,
I could talk about the strength of the entire athletic program, but you forget how many great teams are at UConn. You look at the track teams and the swimming teams. I mean, they're a national brand. So if you get rid of them, then what happens? But this isn't even just specific to UConn. It's happening at universities all over the country.
Sure. And what about the thought, Brian? Final thought here. What about the thought of hoping that more people show up? You know, for football, I mean, winning is great, but I've covered college athletics and been to schools where they say, yeah, we win, but it's kind of a different generation now, Brian, back when you and I were in college, of college student, of campus-based fan who might go to a game or not.
Well, the problem is the stadium isn't on campus. It's 25, 30 minutes away from campus. So when you're out, I mean, and it's a great time. You go, you tailgate, you have fun on nice days in the fall. You have a great time at a UConn football game. But it's like the game is sometimes secondary, it feels like. Mm-hmm. But you got to win games to get people in. Like, they used to fill it up when they were winning. So who's to say it can't happen again?
Now you just go out there and drink, which, hey, if you're getting free booze, why go watch?
Win or lose, it doesn't matter.
That's right. Brian Forrester joins us from instorsnow.com, instorsnow.com. Check out the website. Check out the podcast. Brian, thanks, buddy. We'll be in touch. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, Brian. Brian Forrester, check it out, instorsnow.com. As we speak, according to numbers released late yesterday by the state of Connecticut, of the tragic 4,146 deaths in the state, out of 4,100 plus deaths, almost 64% of those deaths, 63.8%, have occurred in Connecticut nursing homes. That means approximately 2,645 people have died of COVID-19 or from complications of or the disease itself, COVID-19, in the state's nursing homes. Over 2,600 deaths. Suddenly, the governor and state leaders, some of them are suddenly talking tough about this, talking testing. What happens if we get a second wave here? Was this taken seriously enough, or was this, I don't know, something we couldn't do anything about? Returning to the program, friend of the show, State Senator Kevin Kelly, Republican of Stratford. Kevin's also an elder care attorney and the ranking Republican on the Aging Committee. Kevin, how are you? Hope all is well. And these numbers, Kevin, still finally, I guess, there are people now waking up to this.
Yes. And the question you posed in the lead-in is the operative question. And that is this being taken seriously enough? And it's why we need a review. And I know that the governor has called for a third-party independent, I'm going to put that in quotation marks, review. But I'm concerned that it would be the executive that would be doing this, the governor, for two reasons. One is his administration has had a problem with transparency and FOI laws. Boston Consulting Group is a perfect example. And then the second is, he's looking at nursing homes right now as the issue. I think we have to look at nursing homes. We also have to look at hospitals. But I also think we need to look at what did the state do or not do that set us up for the 2,600 plus deaths that occurred so that it never happens again. I mean, Paul, at the end of the day, politics, whichever side we're talking about, these are human lives, and we have to protect this vulnerable population that, this disease is so lethal with. And just to put it also in context, like, what's that 60% mean? That's almost 10% of the individuals who died in nursing homes across the country.
Yeah.
So this is a huge number, and there were other states that got it right. And the first bell that went off in my mind was that when the governor stopped family members from going in, it was because there was a recognition that, you know, the virus is transmitted by one person to the next.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't stop the staff from going in. So you stop the family members who are actually the eyes and ears of people that have a diminished capacity, and they're the ones that make sure that there's proper care. But he didn't stop the staff, and it wasn't until last week that he actually issued an executive order some 3 months after the fact that staff should now be testing. And I think that was one of the, you know, issues that we waited too long. I shouldn't say we, the governor waited too long to really put that executive order in. We could have done testing even if the state didn't have capacity. One of the, I'm going to say, symptoms is a fever.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody had a high temperature, you know, let's check this out. Let's be a little bit more cautious. Let's be a little bit protective. But we need to get to the bottom of this so that we can protect human life.
Kevin, if you could just explain to my listeners here, because you obviously know this, being an elder care attorney, being in the General Assembly, how exactly are nursing homes in this state, Kevin, monitored and regulated? What's the regulatory structure here in the state for many of these homes that are privately owned?
Many are privately owned, and the regulations come in from a whole host of places in the state government. Particularly here, it would be the Department of Public Health. They do have Medicaid oversight and regulations. There's labor with regards to employment. But when we sit down and talk about what we're looking at here with infection, you know, you do have the DPH. That's one where you can look at infection rates and what were we doing with known facilities. I mean, it's not just the COVID virus, but if you're in a nursing home, it could be C. diff, it could be staph. There's mm-hmm. a whole host of viruses that are very lethal to seniors. And if homes had a history of this, they would be known to DPH. And did DPH look at that as COVID came out and said, oh, you know, this is one that's had trouble with infection. Are we going to deal with that and maybe put some resources into this? You know, the state is getting a $1.4 billion COVID check from the federal government. And where's that money going to go? I mean, I would hope some of it would land in the nursing homes, but that's what we look at. And then you look at things like the PPE. The Department of Administrative Services was the department that dealt with that. Did they get proper PPE? Did we have the proper policies in place to make sure that we got timely delivery and that there weren't other issues, you know, as to finance, as to whether or not they wanted to pay or get deliveries? And when did they come and where did it go? You know, did it come to nursing homes? Once again, the proper testing. And so there, it's a heavily regulated industry. And one of the issues mm-hmm. Historically, since I've been up there, is that they are woefully underfunded because for the most part, they're funded through Medicaid, which is a discount. It only pays about 70% of the Medicaid dollar or the healthcare yeah. dollar for the care. And while the state has given them some relief with regards to salaries, as far as a general reimbursement increase, it's only been like 1% in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's very tough to run a business, particularly a business that's taking care of human life like they do. And for the most part, you know, the people that do work in these facilities and the facilities themselves do a wonderful job and a great job taking care of people in, you know, very difficult circumstances. And it's part of the chronic care continuum.
And Kevin, I did read, though, you've probably seen these reports as well. There are scattered reports of, believe it or not, some nursing homes that had very few, if any, COVID cases. I mean, they've proven, Kevin, and look, no home is the same, where they are, the location, what kind of patient they get, that's all moved into the equation here. But it seems to be that there are some nursing homes out there that prove, or have proven, it can be done to hold this damage to a minimum.
Exactly, Paul. And I think that's what we have to do is learn from this experience, however painful it has been, to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And what we need to do is make sure that the administration is not going to have a review to find a scapegoat so that they're protecting their political base. What we need to do is get to the root cause. Why did certain facilities do really well? Why did some facilities do really poorly? What were the best practices that were employed? And what can we do as a state to make sure that this doesn't happen again and that we don't, come October, November, have another 2,600 of the greatest generation pass because they caught a virus?
Kevin, hang on. We'll be back with you. More on nursing homes with State Senator Kevin Kelly, Republican Stratford. He knows from whence he speaks. He is the ranking member, ranking Republican on the Aging Committee, also an elder care attorney. Kevin, hang on. Traffic and weather together. 516 on WICC. And a few more minutes here with our buddy Stratford GOP State Senator Kevin Kelly right in your backyard. He is the ranking member on the Aging Committee. In the Capitol, and also an elder care attorney by trade. Kevin, we have, I think, 215 or so, or 220 nursing homes in the state. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do we have a nursing home ombudsman or anything like that? And if we don't, could you see something like that being created? Because I know you said we have all these other departments, but Kevin, I would think with 200-plus nursing homes, that probably would be a good thing to have, and maybe some staff as well.
Yes, Paul. We have a state ombudsman.
Okay.
It's Mairead Painter.
Okay.
And she handles all, you know, complaints and issues with regards to skilled nursing facilities.
Okay.
One of the bills that I fought for and we passed, it was either the last session or the session before, was to extend their jurisdiction so that it also deals with home care. And that is something that we're starting to build out and start to create more capacity. So if somebody has problems at home, because if we want to transition people from nursing homes to their homes so they can age in place, because we all know that it's less expensive, it's arguably better, and it's what everybody wants.
Yeah.
That if we're going to do that, then we also need to make sure we have the infrastructure in place so that if you have a problem with a home care provider or a Meals on Wheels or something, that there's an actual advocate that you can go to bring your grievance. And she, you know, she has an office in Hartford, and I know that she's been doing yeoman's work with everything mm-hmm. that's been going on with the families who haven't been able to see their loved ones, and, you know, working toward, you know, what we're trying to do now is get more outdoor visits that are PPE protected yeah. and socially distanced so that, you know, our seniors can at least get a breath of fresh air and feel the sunshine on their face.
I know that we can always use more money for every department, but Kevin, does Ms. Painter, do you think her department is staffed both personnel-wise and resource-wise, money-wise? Do you think she has the staffing she needs, or could we do better there?
Well, Paul, I think, you know, I often say if I ran the zoo, things would look a lot different.
You'd move the giraffes over here and the lions over there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's what are your priorities? You know, I value my elders. I value my parents. I believe that we don't put enough resources that our seniors deserve, not only their independence, but their dignity and health care. And this is one of those things that, you know, we often become penny wise and pound foolish, particularly in the area of skilled facilities. And we don't give the necessary, resources to enable aging in place, which is less expensive. And I think one thing we're learning here in this COVID experience is that the seniors that were in nursing homes were very suspect to this lethal virus, not so much in the community because they didn't have quite the exposure, quite the density in population that you do in skilled assisted living and residential care homes. So it's almost an argument that let's see if we can't put the resources into a Medicaid program that, once again, Paul, it's home care, which is where people want to stay. They want to age in place. but it's less expensive. It's about a third of the cost of a nursing home. And, you know, because there's less infection, it's you know, a better care environment.
Kevin.
Yes.
Yeah, Kevin, finally, my relatives have been, you know, they passed long ago, so it's been a while since I was handling their care. What is a decent nursing home room per month charge right now? You may know this because of your line of legal work, because I remember when I had my mom and dad in homes and some elderly relatives I took care of, I remember the figures of $6,000 to $7,000 a month. Are we still around there, or is it more or less? How is that?
Paul, I wish it were $6,000 or $7,000,
really,
a month. Right now, the long-term care facility rate that the state pays for a Medicaid bed is around $13,000 a month.
Wow.
And your private pay starts anywhere from that $13,000 to, I mean, if you're in the better facilities, you're in more in the neighborhood of about $18,000, you know, with the median being somewhere around $15,000 to $17,000 a month. You know, that's a substantial outlay, you know, $13,000 even to the taxpayers for paying for Medicaid. Home care, on the other hand, if you had a live-in around the clock, you're more along the lines of about $6,500 to $6,500. So you can be, you know, and if you're just using a couple hours a day, then now you're down in the neighborhood of $3,000 or $4,000 a month. And that's where, you know, from a taxpayer perspective, if people want to be home, it's arguably better and less expensive. Why aren't we trying and endeavoring to do this? And every time we bring up an initiative, and I put a whole host of them over the past 10 years I've been there, you get a lot of impediments from many of these departments that are exercising all this regulatory control. But the fact of the matter is, you know, people want to stay at home. And it's, you know, it's just you see the numbers. $13,000 a month is substantial.
Wow, that's wow. For many people, you know, 1 year and their whatever savings they have are gone. Kevin, thank you. Kevin Kelly, be good. Have a happy weekend. We'll be in touch. Thanks, Kevin.
Hey, take care, Paul.